So I don't know if we're ever gonna do an episode on Marvel's the series,
Oh, hey, okay.
but because probably I don't mean it's
I really want to do Marvels, and I was actually going to suggest that, but then we wanted to do like a long series, and I was like, well, Marvels would be one episode, so I'm going to pitch Thunderbolts because I've been thinking about that because of the movie, which that's the one thing I didn't bring up in my
What,
notes
there's
here.
a Thunderbolts movie?
Oh yeah, this was
Oh, I
kind of
didn't even know.
this is what inspired me is that they just dropped the trailer
Oh.
for
Is it
the
any
new
of the same
Marvel.
characters, though?
No, this is the thing. So there, it's a Thunderbolts movie in that they are compiling a bunch of surviving villains into a superhero team. So the new Thunderbolts in this movie is going to be the Winter Soldier, as the kind of most famous character, and then the new Black Widow that's played by Frances Pugh, and then they have the US agent, which is in the Winter Soldier Falcon TV series.
Like the Agents of Shield guy or no?
So there was
He's
like
only in that one series. He hasn't been in anything else.
he tried to replace Captain America with another guy, and then he kind of went a little crazy and killed someone.
Yeah, he wasn't a great
Oh.
guy.
Oh.
Yeah. Which
Jeez.
is in canon, this is an actual character that Captain America went away and they tried to replace him with this guy, and he kind of was not great. And
Well, that was a mistake.
but he's still around. He's called US Agent, but he wears a black Captain America costume. Anyways, and then the Ghost and Taskmaster, which are from some of the other movies. Oh, and the David Harbour, who was the Russian guy. Basically, like a bunch of the villains from the Black Widow movie are all in this Thunderbolt.
All the movies that not a lot of people have seen.
Yeah. Anyways, I don't know. It's the idea of villains who have to act as heroes. That's kind of the flimsy reason why they're calling it a Thunderbolts movie. But that being said, I was looking into the history of the comics, and like, it's kind of sad because like I read this run, and then Kurt Busiek left, and another writer took over who did a lot of stuff for the X-Men. The names I'm blanking out right now, but Hawkeye actually becomes the team leader with Zemo gone, and Hawkeye becomes their leader because he's inspired. Like he's like, I used to be a villain, and I knew what it was like to have a bad rap, and I want to help you guys. And so they had a whole second run with Hawkeye as team leader, and I had a lot of fun reading that. That was great. And then the series kind of fell on hard times, and they kept trying to rebrand it. And so, like for a while, it was basically like a really cheap Suicide Squad knockoff, where they had like the Green Goblin and Bullseye, and they had like explosives in their skulls.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, the movie you were describing just sounds like another Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
So,
But
like, I don't know.
that's what you do. You're right. You find a movie that made money and you say, we're gonna do one of those.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like the Thunderbolts movie being announced made me nostalgic for the comics. Also, then it made me a little more irritated about how they've completely missed the point in this movie. But like, I don't know, it was fun to go back and kind of revisit these characters because, like I said, I read this when I was like 17 years old. And the other thing I didn't share last episode was I used to sit down with my little brother, who was probably like 9 or 10, and I would like read the comics to him, and I would do voices for all the characters.
Oh, that's sweet.
He has fond memories of the Thunderbolts because I would read him issues of the Thunderbolts.
Well, I'm glad you surfaced it because I had never heard of it. I had no concept of this movie at all. So it's throwing something into my field that I would not have encountered otherwise, and I'm very grateful for that. And I'm
And I
going
have
to
to say,
say,
like, even though I was reading Marvel Comics in 1997 for sure, I don't remember Thunderbolts at all. I definitely never read any of it. I don't think I was aware that it existed or I've forgotten that it was.
I mean, like I say, I think a big part of this was like Mark Bagley is just like my all-time, well, I mean, sorry, I guess my opinions have changed now that I'm older, but when I was a teenager, Mark Bagley was like my guy. He was like my favorite artist. And it's weird reading this again because like I realize how much his art is part of my comics DNA. Because like I will do flowing organic hair and like organic character designs, totally influenced by him. Like,
I will say, like, actually, when reading this, I did pick up on several things. And I'm like, this looks like it influenced Jeff quite a lot. So I could see that in your work.
I
Absolutely.
mean, I much prefer your work to his, but I can see the basic structure. And I feel like this is like the same for me too, where I was reading a lot of comics that I'm not gonna make any of you read on Trade Readers when I was a teenager. But that DNA is there. Like I
Yeah, same.
draw hair the way I do in no small part because Chris Bacalo drew hair a certain way that I thought was cool in the 90s.
Yeah. Oh, there's another one that is.
Definitely.
But yeah, I mean,
And we're in an episode, so
Sorry, yeah, I guess we should. So here we are. This is part two of Thunderbolts. So we had a really good discussion about kind of just like the state of the industry and like the Marvel method, and we kind of really set the table for Marvel superheroes circa 1996. And I think we decided maybe for this episode we would try to dig in a little more onto the characters and the story, and maybe also talk about, like, since we pointed out quite a few flaws, maybe ways we might improve on executing a story like this in the future. So maybe because we usually start with introductions, I'll go through really quick. So we can do our introductions. I have another character building question. This time I was going to ask, have you ever been peer pressured? Do you feel like you've ever had a time where you really felt like you got peer pressured, or just, or maybe like not even peer pressured, but like influenced by the group that you were in? And if you guys want a minute for that, I'll start this one. So I'm Jeff Ellis, and I specifically thought about this in the context of Thunderbolts because, like, when I was, I don't know, 12, 13, I was in Boy Scouts, and there were a lot of bad kids in our Boy Scout troop, and I thought they were super cool, and I became friends with them, and I was just another bad kid in this scout troop, making all the scout leaders super stressed out and unhappy. And I think back on how I acted in the scout troop when I was a 13, 14-year-old, and I'm like, oh my God, it is so lucky that like none of the adults punched me in the face, because I would have deserved it. And we are all terrible. We all influenced each other to be terrible. And so I think about the Thunderbolts and how maybe like maybe part of being a Masters of Evil is you're hanging out with a bad crowd, and then you just need somebody in group to kind of be like, hey, what if we're not crappy? And then maybe influence people for the better.
I'm JD. I can't think of a specific episode, not to say that this never happened, where I was peer pressured to do something terrible. I did have terrible friends when I was in middle school. They were terrible people, and I don't think they ever influenced me to do anything positive. I don't know. I mean, I never did anything too terrible, I think, but I definitely was subject to bad influences, let's say. There is I have never looked any of those people up on Facebook or online since then, because like I don't want to know. It's not gonna be good.
And I'm Jam, and ironically, I think most of the problems in my childhood could be summed up as being I'm too dense to understand what you're trying to peer pressure me to do. And so quite often people would be like, you're supposed to be this way or that way. And I'd just be like, oh, but that doesn't sound interesting to me, and I don't want to do that. And it's like, so we're gonna bully you instead. And I'm like, I don't get it. I don't understand. And in terms of peer influence, ironically, there was like a period of high school. I moved around a lot, but there was one specific high school where a bunch of us, like outcast nerds, I don't think any of them would be upset by me characterizing them as that, but a bunch of us outcast nerds got together and we got really into like anime and comics and talked about that together. And I learned so much about that world from them, and we learned from each other. Many of us drew and wrote, and we were really creative together. It was a really formative time, and I'm still friends with many of the people from that group specifically, and not from the high school after that, ironically. So yeah, I guess I suck at being peer pressured. Sorry. If you've been trying to peer pressure me into doing something, I'm not going to be able to figure it out. You just have to tell me.
Been trying to peer pressure you to being into superhero comics for the entire duration.
I know, but it's so pants. I'm sorry. You'll just have to bully me instead. Don't. I know. Now at this point, I cannot be bullied anymore, so that's a blessing.
Yeah,
As I will beat you up.
when we left, we were talking about Baron Zemo, this guy who's a Nazi, and is like basically the main character of this entire story, which I had mixed feelings about the whole way through.
I guess. Yeah.
I was going to actually suggest, because we talk about sort of the every character having three names, and I did have a list, so I was actually going to suggest, would you want to go through kind of one character at a time? You mentioned Zemo, let's start there. Yeah, he is a classic Captain America villain. He's the son of a classic Captain America villain. I don't know at what point his face got horribly burned, but the entire duration I've known him as a character, he's been horribly disfigured and hides his face under his purple mask. He showed up in a spectacular Spider-Man storyline that I read when I was 13 that still gives me chills. And I don't know, it's interesting in this series. I feel like Busiek's working overtime to give him this really verbose dialogue that's just super over the top.
I mean, that seems appropriate. It
It did seem to suit him. Like I was saying this in the last episode, like he did have a very appropriate bearing for a super villain.
And like I know Jeff, last episode you were theorizing that maybe editorial was pushing on back on the idea of having a Nazi character doing Nazi things. I think I'm going to say pleasantly surprised to see that we weren't denied that side of him, that he was explicitly a white supremacist whose father was like basically enslaving indigenous people. And like that whole chapter is
That
not.
was a wild chapter.
Yeah, I have issues with that chapter, but the intent of the chapter, I think, is like, yeah, okay, this is. We're not supposed to like this guy. We're never asked to like this guy. We're never expected to really. I don't think it's necessary for us to really understand him as a character because I don't care.
Yeah, I did find it interesting how there was kind of this generational aspect. Where you see like him and his dad chilling in the hot tub of super goo or something. I don't really understand what was happening, but it seemed very clear that these were like the ideals that were passed down to him from his father, which was interesting, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot there, and maybe more could have been done with it, but I feel like that's with the benefit of it not being 1997 that I'm saying that.
I mean, the super goo is just a hand wave for like why someone from World War II was still like walking
Kicking.
around like physically fit and appearing to be like 40 years old.
If they had done this now, that would be like the Silicon Valley, like injecting the blood of children or whatever. But anyway, that indigenous chapter was weird. The thing that I picked up on throughout this run, or maybe about this universe, which is kind of strange, is that the things in New York are super specific and real. But then they go to this like indigenous South American M Mexico question mark. Like,
Well,
this
that
is
one
very
was, they
vague.
said that one was Brazil. There's a lot of other places. And I'm like, that's not what Brazil looks like.
No. Okay. But then there were like other places that were just
That are
made up,
made up
like the
countries.
like a made up Latin American country that had been destabilized or something. And I'm like, don't like that.
Like Marvel, the Marvel Universe has done stuff like that for a long time. I think it started out as these are stories for 11-year-olds, and so we don't want to talk about real politics, but then they're still doing it at a time where like that they're writing for older people who could like deal with that sort of story and not how you don't have to hand wave it and make up a
Yeah.
country every time.
Heaven forbid a child learn something.
Yeah. I mean, specifically I'm gonna blame the art in that specific scene. Is I think the thing that needed to be different.
Yeah, it felt really out of place, really anachronistic,
Yeah,
inaccurate.
very inaccurate to what anything would have looked like in the 20th century, specifically because I'm sure there are companies even today who are essentially enslaving people in the middle of the Brazilian rainforest, but the people who that is happening to don't dress like this, they don't look like this, they don't have giant stone pyramids. It takes like 5 minutes on Google to figure that out.
Well, they didn't
Yeah.
have Google,
This
but
is that that's no excuse.
I agree it's not an excuse,
It
but
takes half an hour at the library.
yes, it did, would have taken half an hour at the library or a very
That's
short plane ride.
the
Yeah.
way to
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is, yeah. That was the one. I mean, again, I'm picking this work from 1996, and I was kind of like, oh, I think everything's okay, you know? And then that chapter, I was like, oh, yeah.
it. I don't
It's
know.
like
I mean, we don't need to talk
perfect.
about it all day. It's just
No,
it's worth noting.
exactly. Like it's of its time, but we can't let it pass without comment.
Yeah. No. I mean, at least, yeah, at least it was done in the service of trying to be like, and that's why this guy's evil and should be stopped. Yeah. 2024 would probably have both sides.
Oh,
Okay.
yeah, if it was done in 2024, it would definitely be written worse. Drawn
Oh.
better, but written worse.
Oh yeah.
Oh,
Anyway, Atlas, can we talk about Atlas next? Because he was also there in this scene that we're describing,
yeah.
being like a henchman, and he's like, I'm a henchman and that's my identity. I do hench things.
Yeah,
So
he's.
what were his three elf names?
Oh,
He had like five or six.
I have three names.
Yeah,
Yeah, he was
he
like
was
Atlas,
Goliath.
Goliath, and he was also he had some Johannes kind of name. I
Like he had
forget.
a name before that too, yeah.
Eric Johnston is his civilian name, and then his villainous persona is Goliath, but yeah, his superhero name is Atlas. Eric Johnston was
He
kind of
was
like,
also Power Man at one point.
yeah, that's right. He was Power Man. He had the name Power Man, which is they make a joke about that in the Heroes for Hire thing. But he basically was like a villainous version of Giant Man. So like Ant-Man can go small and go big. So I think he had the same Pym particles that allowed him to grow. So, you know, he just used his power to grow gigantic for villainy instead of for good.
I
He's been kind of
actually,
a,
I did like this character.
yeah.
I found him personable. I didn't mind. He was a little, oh, you know, just going along with what's happening. But
Yeah,
I found it endearing in a certain way.
I feel like that's what's interesting about his character is that I mean, I've never read any other comics with him in it besides this one, but it feels like he's just a generic henchman. And like, what kind of a person becomes a generic henchman? Someone who just like kind of goes along with it. Like, I said,
Yeah,
oh, I don't know,
actually
Baron Zemo told me to do this. I'm going to do it.
I felt that was very, very on point. And I liked where
Mean,
they took his character. I liked the little like side flaying that he was having with the representative from City Hall or whatever. Like it was cute. I liked it.
yeah, the point where he sort of he looks like his character arc is that he's gonna end up in a good place, and then Baron Zemo like does his scheme and like expects everyone to follow him, and Atlas like disappointingly goes along with him still. Like that feels like that was like, yeah, that's his arc. Yeah.
One thing that I think is worth noting is like in one of the flashbacks, I think when Jolt is getting the origin of the Thunderbolts from Zemo, one of the core events of the team coming together is Zemo and the Fixer rescuing Goliath, rescuing Atlas from whatever like negative zone or whatever. Like so he is, I don't
Yeah,
know
I
what
didn't understand
happened.
any of this.
No, I mean that's the
Me neither.
issue with 25 of Thor or whatever. I don't know, but like I do, you'd have to go hunt the back issues for the details, but like essentially at the end of whatever story where he was fighting whatever hero, he got his he got destabilized and his he was trapped in this other dimension and was like in torment. And so like Zemo used science to like pull him back into the earthly plane and save his life. And so yeah, it's true he is kind of a dumb henchman, but I think that that was kind of the core dilemma for him was I think he felt like he owed his life to Zemo, and that was like the resolution where he turns on Zemo, but when it at the very end Zemo asks him for help to get in the escape pod, so he's like, "This is the last thing I do for you. You save my life, I save your life. We're done now.
I
We're
really
clean."
liked that resolution. Though I think we mentioned before that like character arcs were done quite well in this, and I thought that as a character arc was quite good.
And then they also set up his like little sister so that he's gonna want to like protect Jolt, which is I think like a good dynamic, which I always appreciate a superhero story where the characters are not getting romantically entangled with the teenage characters in the series. So
Nice.
like the big brother role was good. I like that. But I don't know. Atlas was one of my favorites. I think he's kind of like ultimately I feel like he was kind of the heart and soul of the team overall. Like this is maybe after this arc, I think he really became one of the kind of core people. I was just thinking in general, when you look at superhero teams, like there's kind of tropes for superhero teams, and like you've got to have your big dumb guy. Atlas is our big dumb guy.
He's the
Zemo,
tank.
our leader, our skillful leader. Is there more to say about Atlas?
Who's next?
About Meteorite, aka Moonstone.
So Meteorite was the one I didn't mind her as a character, but her backstory pissed me off the most. I just like I got lost about three steps deep and I stopped caring. I mean, she was like at the end of the day, there was like some part in the back matter is like, oh yeah, here's her first appearance. She's a stewardess with a gun, question mark. I'm like, I thought she was a psychologist. I'm so confused.
I don't know. I mean, they at the very back they have the like first appearance in Captain America where she is just apparently just wearing like bullets as a top. But like
I
I
think it's
don't
the perils of having an extended universe with like lots of creators is some of those stories are gonna be really bad, and now you get to write this character.
It's almost like she could have been just a different character from that Captain America appearance.
But
Like,
that's not how comics works.
at some point, she became a psychiatrist and came in contact with this magic stone and got powers. She can fly. She's kind of invulnerable and she's strong, like your basic power set. But I actually found like I don't know. I one thing I liked is that ultimately her real superpower was her psychiatry. She how to say things to get, she knew what buttons to push on you. She knew how to manipulate you by your psychiatric profile.
She had a really good line regarding the psychiatry, where I think it was her and not the fixer, what's his techno or whatever. Like techno was like, oh, we gotta do this thing, and it's like, oh, don't like reverse psychology him to death or whatever. And then later on he's like, ah, help, I need the psychology. And then she's, I'm sorry, I'm ad-libbing here based on very thin memory, but she says something to the effect of like, don't like begrudge my profession. Like you were being a real jerk about this. And she had a really good line there. Let me see if I can find it.
I did like, I mean, as much as it's pretty ham-fisted to say, oh, she has this ability over people because she's a psychologist, like I liked her personality in this mix where she's basically her motivation is like completely sideways to everybody else, and like I don't think she even has her motivation totally figured out, except that she just likes having power over people. It makes the story much more interesting to have her there.
Well, like, I mean, they kind of set her up at the beginning again with the origin story where they broke her out of prison without consulting with her. So she's just Oh, well, now I'm going to serve more time for being part of this breakout. I may as well go with you. But then it's kind of like, yeah, she's not really on board. She's just like, well, okay, this is the situation I'm in. How do I bend this to my advantage? I think that, again, having the advantage of reading further ahead in the story, like Moonstone, or sorry, Meteorite continues to be serving her own ends, throughout the series. And even when they rebooted Thunderbolts, she was still part of the like Suicide Squad-esque team later on. Like she's been, again, kind of a real staple Thunderbolt character. And I think it's because she's a fun character in that she's always kind of there to kind of work against the person in charge, she was trying to manipulate Hawkeye when he took over as leader later on when they were like the Suicide Squad. Norman Osborn was in charge and she was trying to manipulate him. Like she's just like she's a fun character in that regard.
I did like her subversive dynamic.
Yeah, and I like her as a counterpoint to this like boring Nazi guy who's like basically a cardboard cutout because of course he is. Like the fact that she's willing to work with him up to a point is interesting, but then obviously that's not gonna go well in the end because like he's too much motivated by this one thing and like what she wants is something different.
I think it was good. I will say I thought her in the like issue negative one or whatever, the issue zero, where they kind of did extra backstory for the characters. They have her like talking to a friend about her psychiatric practice, and then in front of her friend, she's like, "Hang on, I got to make a phone call," and she calls and pretends to be like a mistress calling for the husband of her patient, and then to her friend, she's just like, "Oh yeah, I have to do this to like keep my practice going," and you're just like, "Why would you do that in front of someone? Why would you
Well,
like?"
it starts from like where she's telling her friend like the name and backstory of one of her patients, like, right from the get-go.
Well,
She's not
that's a HIPAA
a good
violation. You can't do
psychologist.
that.
Just like I think she's more of a villain when she was a psychologist.
Oh yeah, probably. Yeah, actually. I mean, I think that the idea of her being an unethical psychiatrist or psychologist or whatever, like that's a fun story. It's like the execution where it's just like so on the nose. I was like, what? Why don't you just like do this for the benefit of the readers? We don't need to have her like.
This is a superhero comic associated with the Avengers written in 1997. It doesn't do subtle.
Fair enough. I don't know.
I would like it to, but it won't.
The friend wasn't needed. Like we could have just had been a
No,
fly on the.
all of that was needed.
Okay. All right.
That's how we knew she was a bad psychologist, is she, like that she's telling her friend things that should be kept.
Yeah. I also just was going to say, because I keep getting Meteorite and Moonstone mixed up, I almost feel like that was intentional because they clearly intentionally had Techno misname her in a fight, which caused readers to write all these panicked letters to the editor that issue. I thought it was very clever because, like, reading this, it slipped past me. I was like, oh,
Oh yeah, me
shit.
too.
Techno did call her Moonstone on camera. I missed that.
Oh, interesting. So there were panic letters like in our world.
Human, like, yeah, sorry.
But hang on, was this in an issue when we knew that they were villains?
Yeah,
Because we knew in the first issue, it said it at the end.
The reveal was issue one, but like, so that the letters to the editor in that issue, people were like, oh my gosh, like Techno dropped the ball. Techno like name dropped like Moonstone. Like people are gonna notice, like the Thunderbolts are gonna get revealed. Like, oh, like,
He
but then
doxed
it's one of those like a red.
before anyone knew that word.
It was a, I don't know. I think that's one thing I kind of enjoyed with Busiek's approach is he clearly likes to sort of have little clues and references, and he doesn't do stuff with all of them. So it's like you have a few red herrings, then you have a few like actual threads that connect. But I think he's doing that in the service of the fandom, so the fandom can kind of be like, oh, is something going to come of this? Oh, is something going to come of this? So yeah.
He seems to understand the dynamic of working with this community of letter writers well.
Yeah, he knows the assignment. I don't know that I would be able to, well, I mean, I would just be very different, but like he is expert at managing with the requirements of the specific job he has.
Yeah. How about Mac One, aka the Beetle, aka Abner Jenkins?
I feel like he's the one that him and Songbird were the ones where I most believed their arc was like uncomplicated, where they just ended up as supervillains somehow, and their arc towards being superheroes was the longest of the arcs. Like it started the earliest and ended up exactly where you thought it would.
And it made the most sense, given their backstory and like the circumstances that led to them becoming super villains. It does make the most sense that they'd be the ones most likely to be more willing to switch sides. So
Yeah.
I liked that. I liked their relationship on like I don't know how to put this. I like the fact that they had a relationship with Songbird, sorry. And I liked the way that developed. There was quite a bit of ham-handedness, maybe like
Yeah.
immaturity in like the handling of that relationship that I didn't quite vibe with. But I really like Songbird, and I like Songbird Mach 1 as a dynamic. Mach
Yeah.
1 was probably, I think, the least interesting character on the team if it wasn't for this relationship,
Absolutely.
in my
Yeah.
opinion.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting because I have the most history with this character because like the Beetle would often fight Spider-Man. And so like the team up issue where like Mach 1 is just like, cool, yeah, I'm gonna get that Spider-Man. I'm like, ah, yeah, that's fun. Like
I don't know. I mean, I've never read a lot of DC comics, but I know that in DC there is a blue beetle, and I kept having to remind myself, no, not that beetle.
okay,
It's the
yeah.
beetle you've never heard of.
So there was also a movie recently about a beetle. This is not that
Yeah, that was
beetle.
DC. That was the other one.
Oh my God. Okay.
No. It's the blue beetle, not the beetle.
Oh, my mistake.
Right? Yeah.
I'm serious. The whole way, because they're pretty similar. They get their powers from a suit or something.
Think someone was infringing on someone's copyright, but.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. Okay, who's next? Songbird?
Songbird, yeah.
I
Melissa Cole,
liked
Screaming
Songbird.
Mimi.
So I didn't like Screaming Mimi. Screaming Mimi made no sense. I did not like that. I did not like her backstory with the other dude who shouted or something, and then he just randomly died. I thought that was very boring and strange. But I really liked Songbird and her powers and how she was kind of like unsure of herself and then came into her own. I thought like the whole structure of her powers was really unique. I thought it was used to really interesting visual and narrative effect. So in general, I really liked Songbird.
Yeah, my favorite moment was near the end when they have to fight the heroes and the Invisible Woman puts up her barrier and she's like, you can't get through this barrier. And then Songbird's like, well, I can hear you, which means my sounds can get to the other side of that barrier. Boom, I was like, that's great. I love
Yeah, I
it.
just like that this is because it's so rare. This is why I can never say anything too bad about Kurt Busiek, is like it's so rare in this era of comics, this genre of comics, for characters to have an arc and to stick to that arc, and like that her arc is so important to the story and is able to play out from beginning to end, like beat for beat without like missing a step, is
Yeah.
like, yeah, that is down to the skill of the author working with like the 10 editors and five other writers who get to play with these characters to say, no, here's the arc, you got it, it's all there, nothing's missing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there was some really good stuff. Like I did enjoy like they had the whole issue where it was like Songbird on her own and it's like she's the one person that the rest of the team's been incapacitated by the elements of doom. And she's the one that has to like save the day. And they've kind of set her up as this insecure, uncertain character, and she sort of like has to step up, and she does. And like, yeah, I think there was a lot of character growth throughout the 12 issues, and yeah, she is definitely a highlight character. I mean, and that's again having Mach 1 to kind of play off of the two of them, it makes a good dynamic, but it's definitely the Songbird and Mach 1 show, not the Songbird show.
Yeah.
Fine.
But that's fair enough. I
Yeah.
think, like, Mach 1 is a suitable romantic interest for Songbird, the character we care about, like.
I did enjoy the fact that, like, again, because the Beetle is a long-standing villain who's been around for a while, and so I like that he kind of brought this mentorship where he's like, I've been a villain for so long, like, let me tell you, I'll show you how to fight. This is how you use your flying powers to fight. I've been doing this for decades. I was like, I like that. That's fun dynamic. Let's finish up the main villains with Techno, aka the Fixer, aka Norbert Ebersol, aka the first incel. We're just
I like Techno as a character. I did not like him as a person. I thought he had a really, really interesting dynamic and arc. I felt like he was written in a way that felt true to the type of character that he was and played for really fun effect. So it was fun to read scenes with Techno in him. He was kind of an asshole, but in a way that he was supposed to be.
For sure. I like that he, at the beginning, he's one of the people who are like not fully on board with like working for Baron Zemo, and he needs to sort of be talked into it. And then at the in the end, that very sort of like selfishness is what keeps him on Zemo's side. I thought that was really interesting. Like that made him like quite a bit different from the other characters in an interesting way.
Yeah, I think he's probably the one who most had to be talked into being good. And that was interesting. I thought he brought interesting powers to the table. I really liked the part where he just like died randomly. And then
And
he's
he's
like,
totally fine with
he's
it.
cool. Like, I just need a new body. Whatever. This is better than it was before. This is awesome, actually. And then spent the rest of the series being like, isn't it so awesome how my metal, robot body can do this? And everyone's like, we get it. Shut up, Techno. was fun. I enjoyed that.
I thought that was like peak Marvel Comics, because it's like we have a character like Techno, and then they're fighting elements of Doom, and like it appears that he got his neck snapped at the end of the issue, and it's like, oh my God, cliffhanger, like did he just get killed? And then they start the issue and it's like, oh my God, he did get killed. And then just like he shows up. He's like, no, it's okay. I uploaded my consciousness into my tech pack, and now I have a robot body now. And then he's just like, yeah, man, I just have a robot body now. And like other people on the team are like, isn't that kind of fucked up? Like, weird that you don't have a body anymore? Like, you just died. Are you okay? Like, and he's just like, whatever. Like,
Like, this is
yeah, I
great,
like him as
actually.
a
This is
contrast.
preferable.
I like him as a contrast to so many other characters where ridiculous things like this happen to them. And like he's the one who's like, yeah, it's fine. I like this better, actually. Good contrast to a very, very, very common trope.
Yeah, so I liked Techno for that aspect.
A lot of fun. He was a lot of fun. But yeah, the way he was written, like especially in that, again, that negative one issue, like it starts with him on a date and he's just like, oh, just be honest, you're not gonna call. I don't need women anyways. And he like runs to his like lab and you're just like, oh my God. Like,
Yeah, I mean, this comes,
course
we've
you're a
talked about this
villain.
already, how like a lot of this seems very prescient of like 30 years later. And not in the sense that like Kurt Busiek is secretly a time traveler and he's writing about 2024, but like, yeah, all this stuff kind of happened, but not in the way that he wrote, because like who could have predicted any of this in like that long ago? Just it's just weird and interesting. I don't know.
No, for sure. Okay, so then the last character, Jolt, aka Haley Takahama, who does not have another alter ego because Haley was like a home made homeless by the Onslaught incident and then got kidnapped and experimented on and gained superpowers, and then Meteorite convinced Citizen V to let Jolt join the team to sort of add further credence to their role as superheroes, which then
But
meant
clearly she was doing it as a way, like, here's another piece on the board that I can maybe use later.
yeah, absolutely. What I think it maybe pushed the issue, because if Jolt is there, they have to be in their hero personas 24/7, which is gonna, especially with Mach 1 and Songbird, definitely gonna get them way more out of the headspace of being a villain and into the headspace of being a hero. But yeah, I don't know. I when Jolt is Jolt, I like Jolt being on the team. I found it really strange that it's had to be this weird protracted, like, for the first whatever 4 issues, we have to keep checking in on this girl who's being like abused and tortured. And I mean, I understand they're doing this as a teaser. They're trying to like, oh, what's going on with Haley Takahama? What's going to happen? Oh, she's a hero. That was fun, but like, it's unfortunate that like her powers are from being like kidnapped and tortured. And then my other thing that as much as I like Mark Bagley, oh boy, he cannot draw teenage women. He just like, it's, they're women. It's, everyone is a woman and they say that it's a teenager. I'm like, that's not a teenager, but okay, man, like, sure.
She's just kind of small. I agree with you. I liked what Jolt brought to the team. I liked her dynamic. I liked her personality. I thought she was the way she used her powers was drawn in a really interesting way. I didn't like the torture backstory. I liked the backstory of like she was orphaned by Onslaught. I think that was really interesting. I also was not a fan of like the whole like, oh, let's get tortured into having powers. Like, oh boy.
Yeah.
Not my fave.
No, I don't know. I mean, it's, I we're talking about ways to improve things. Like in the Marvel Universe, teenagers manifest mutant powers. Like she could have just
Just,
for real. It seemed
powers.
like, in fact, that's like one of the aspects that I found a little confusing about this situation. It's like, oh no, the Avengers are gone. Where are we going to find heroes? We're in such dire straits. And I'm like, it seems kind of like people with powers are, it seems like it's a dime a dozen around here. It seems like it just happens all the time.
I wonder, like, I'm trying to remember what happened to the X-Men after Onslaught. I think they were, that was when they were in an alternate reality for a while.
Not
The
sure.
Well, the thing with the X-Men was, like, as I mentioned, our fantastic cold open on the last episode, to the rest of the world, it appeared that the X-Men killed all the heroes.
Right, so they don't want them.
Yeah, so they're the basically the world doubled down on their prejudice against mutants in
Oh,
this.
okay. All right. I'll accept that.
But heroes are not mutants for reasons.
Which, I mean, again, that's a whole
That's
other.
a long established
Yeah,
thing
that's a
in
whole
Marvel where
other.
people just don't like mutants for unspecified reasons.
I
That
didn't
is
mean to touch
right.
a nerve.
That is a valid, or that is a valid criticism. I just mean that that's a whole other can of worms to open up. But you are,
But
how do
not
we
the
know?
worm that went into Xavier's brain.
This
Different
person, no.
kind of worm.
This person that can fly is cool, but this person that can fly is a mutant, and I hate him. And like,
Okay.
can't explain that. But
You know, it
that's
makes
the
about as
problem.
much sense as any other kind of prejudice.
And I think that's why they did that, is like it's on the no like everything else in the Marvel universe in this era, it's very on the nose. It's like they want their 11-year-old readers to say it's not fair that Iceman is hated. And this other guy who built an ice suit is like fine.
Okay. Yeah, there's a kind of ham-handedness that happens in Naruto where I've come to call it n metaphor for 6-year-olds.
Yeah,
You know,
exactly. That's
it's metaphor
exactly
for
what it
six year
is.
olds. It's okay.
Yeah.
It's fine.
All right. So, one thing we wanted to talk about this episode, and we better do it now, or we're going to run out of time, is what would we do different? Like, given the fact that there's not much that could be done in 1997. I mean, there are things that could still have been done differently in 1997, obviously, but what would we like to see in this story? that is not there that may or may not have been possible.
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this. And first of all, I don't want to say that this comic is bad in the way that it is. In the context of the time that it was written and the structures it was written under, I think the teams did a good job. You know, I don't want to besmirch anyone's work. If I were to take this whole cloth and apply some of what I know, my instinct, I would try to constrain the focus a little bit. So if I were to write this, I think I would write it from Jolt's perspective only, perhaps.
Oh,
So,
interesting.
and again, like my second fix it is like the torture narrative is not happening. But like, let's start with Jolt's perspective. She has this happy life in New York City. The Avengers are here. Everything's cool and groovy. And then, oh, all of a sudden, like my whole world is turned upside down because the Avengers are gone. There's this power vacuum in the city, and I'm homeless and all of this. Like, following her through that trauma and like, let her be the avatar of the perspective of the city as well, like living through this trauma of losing their heroes. And then somehow, some other way, her powers become awakened and she ends up on this team of Thunderbolts that, you know, she also does witness coming out of nowhere. And, you know, she reacts the way the citizens react. And so at that point, like through her perspective, the getting to know these other characters and kind of coming to see them as comrades, then the reveal that they're villains would be like so much more emotionally impactful, I feel, coming through Jolt's perspective. And then I like that at the end of this story, Jolt really rallies the team and is like, you don't have to be with Baron Zemo. We can like switch. And that's why I think that would be a more powerful way to tackle it. The second thing I would change is about superhero comics in general. And I think this one is not so bad in terms of like trying to get away from what superhero comics fundamentally are. But I think I would approach it with a perspective of like a rule where that each story is its own self-contained thing. And if you want to bring in a monster, a villain of the week, or something, you can do it from whatever comic you want. Take it, bring it in, just drop it there, let it be its existing cool self, but assume no one's ever heard of it. And then, like, instead of having these little editorial boxes of like, oh, we're talking about what happened in Spider-Man number 78, editor, you know, like I would do it in a way that kind of manga does this. So manga, they let you just read the story, and then at the end they have this little editorial section, right? Where they have all of these little squares of like, oh, there was this random thing where they said it was a donut. Actually, it's onigiri, you know, and this is like a Japanese delicacy, and you can read more about it. I feel like it would be really cool to have like, oh, this character popped up. Actually, here's a little bit of backstory about this character. And if you want more, check out this series over here. So those are the two major things that I personally would change.
I like
Kind of
that second idea a lot. I know that there was a certain point soon after this time period where what they decided to do to fix this was to have like the beginning page of the comic would be like little like shots of like here's all the main characters you need to know and like a little bit about them.
Yeah.
But I don't I think your solution works better. Because it's
Yeah,
not that
because
we
I
need to
don't
know the
care at the
characters,
beginning.
we need to like remove the part where it's like references to other stories.
Yeah, because like when I think about lore, I actually, and again, like I've been hemming and hawing over this because I'm like, why don't I like superhero comics? Because I like all of these things in other contexts. And it's like, I like lore. I like deep lore. I like digging around and finding it and figuring it out. But I don't like this assumption that I already know the lore. That's the thing I don't like. I want it to feel like a little treasure hunt for me, or like an exercise for the reader, you know?
Yeah, I can see that as like too, rather than having these things like, oh, here's a link to a comic you should have read,
Yeah.
just write it that way without any connection, and then the readers who have read that other comic get that as a reward. Like,
Yeah.
oh, I get that.
Yeah.
I like haven't read a lot of modern superhero comics, but I get the impression that that is more the approach these days, that they're kind of, there are still references to older characters or older situations, but they're done more in a way that as you say, assumes that the reader isn't familiar with it, and it's there as like a an Easter egg for anyone who is familiar, but it's not a barrier, which I think that that's maybe the issue here, is that some of it's a bit of a barrier, which I was going to mention, like, I think you guys probably noticed this, but like, you know, in the beginning of the Heroes for Hire chapter, they have a double page spread with a summary of who the Heroes for Hire are. They have each of the Heroes for Hire characters with a little bio, and they even have a this issue thing.
Too
So
much,
there was, when I was,
exhausting.
okay, but I was
I
just gonna
didn't
say,
like
when
it.
I was reading Marvel Comics at this time, every Marvel comic started with this two page spread for every issue.
That's what I
And
t that yeah, that's what I'm talking
that
about. Yeah.
intentionally to deal with kind of like the opaqueness that some people were experiencing. And obviously, yeah, like this was not the solution. The solution was like,
Yeah.
we had to like streamline this.
Yeah, because like if you look at that two-page spread, it was absolutely overwhelming because like everyone was there with their own pictures and they had two identities and multiple names. And I'm like, oh my God. Like, even if I had been reading this to that point, I already knew all these people are. I just got so overwhelmed with this much information. It's like,
Yeah,
I just want to get into the story.
I think there's a recognition there that they have a problem. I don't think that the way they were doing it at that time was the solution. Okay, so Jam got to do two things, two wish list things. I want to do two wish list things
Okay,
too.
here, sorry.
Number one, no, I think it's a good format. I'm going to go with it. I think number one is I would like to have fewer big fights. And this is not just this superhero comic. This is superhero comics in general. And this is something that what I felt at the time when I was reading comics. So this is why I stuck with X-Men. And it's more than that, like the sort of tertiary level X-Men, like Generation X and Excalibur, because those are the ones where they spent as little time fighting as possible. And it's a superhero universe, so there's always going to be this sort of expectation that at some point they're going to use their fists. That's just inherent in the genre. But my favorite part was always the build up to that. Like they're hanging out at the mall, they're having conversations on the side, they're feeling angst about their powers, like all that kind of stuff. That was the stuff that kept me reading superheroes, even back when I was a teenager. And I would like more of that from these characters. I feel like I would have cared about the characters a lot sooner if we got more of that. I think you could have done a lot more complex stuff for them because there's a lot to build on here. Like it's a pretty unique situation to have these supervillains working for a Nazi who are not themselves necessarily Nazis. Like how what does that do to you? Like what is that? How do you get yourself in that circumstance, and what is it like to be in that circumstance, and then to end up choosing to be a hero instead? Like, I want more of that sort of like interpersonal character building stuff. And I don't want to have no fighting at all because like they've got superpowers. Like that's how ultimately this is how decisions get made in a superhero universe, is you fight about it. But like that's the core metaphor, but I want more of the character stuff first. And I think that would have been possible in 1997. I don't know if other readers at the time would have agreed with me. I think that's maybe why Generation X and Excalibur weren't the most popular comics at the time, but they were the most popular with me. And then number two thing that I want is I this does connect to what Jam said for your first one, is I would like the reveal of who these characters are to happen more gradually and later, rather than it just being like shouted at us at the last page of the first issue. And I get that that's hard to do in this format where you need to sell issue one and then sell issue two afterwards, and you don't want people writing letters after you've sent out issue five and only then revealed that your main character is a Nazi. You don't want to necessarily surprise readers with that. So it's not an easy thread to, or not an easy needle to thread, but I would like something like that if possible.
Yeah. Oh man, you guys have good recommendations. We can build off anything more. I mean, yeah, I think that you do raise like a good point that I think in a way it's like the monthly format is the problem in that, like, because I would say one of my recommendations would just be like art consistency. Like, let's not have a random issue by a different penciler in the middle here. Let's not have an issue where the art style changes every three pages and we have like 15 inkers. But like, that's just a result of the publishing schedule. Whereas if this was just a set graphic novel that had a beginning, middle, and end, the art team could just work on this at whatever pace they needed so that we could get like a little bit more of a through line of art consistency. So I think that would be like the big one. And then, yeah, I mean, you guys were talking about like discovering the reveal through Jolt's eyes and discovering the reveal later. Like, it's a tough one because, yeah, I think holding off on that reveal would have added more impact. But I think that it's that problem with that monthly format. Like, I remember listening to an interview with the writer on Invincible, and he was saying that, you know, he had this plan for the big reveal of the main character's father being bad to happen like on issue 25 or something, but sales were slumping and the book was probably going to get canceled. And he was talking to a colleague and they were like, well, why don't you just do the reveal next issue? And he's like, well, that's supposed to happen at issue 25. And they're like, well, what do you got to lose? Like, you're probably going to get canceled. So they did the reveal early, and then now Invincible is like an animated series on Amazon. So it's like, I could see, I hear the wisdom in holding off on the reveal, but I also, it's like, then you have to have really compelling superhero stuff to hold your audience for however many issues before you pull the rug out. And so I understand that impulse to go like, okay, the pitch is it's the Avengers, but they're secretly villains. But we gotta like hook people in right away. So issue one, we're telling you this because like we need you to be like, holy shit, that's what makes this different. That's why I'm in for the long haul on this. So yeah, I mean, I don't know if I have any bigger wish list beyond what you guys already talked about, other than yeah, I mean, you were talking about in character dynamics, and I actually went back through and I realized like they had the one issue where they were out of costume and they were gonna just like go chill out in New York. And like I went back and I looked, and it's like they are in civilian wear hanging out in New York for five pages, and Growing Man shows up, and then they're just like in costume fighting people, right? And
Yeah, it was. I really liked that beginning of that issue. Yeah, I see you. I want more Mall Goth. More Goth. Mall time. Mall time for the characters.
Yeah, okay, I'm gonna go down a rabbit hole here and say like the first 12 issues of Generation X was just Mall Gothery. They didn't fight any, they were like in the letter section at the back of Generation X, because I was reading the letter section as I got each issue. People were complaining, like, when are they gonna have a fight? It's all just like Mall Goth stuff. Not literally, but you know what I mean. And like, no, but that's what I'm here for. It got boring in issue 12 when they had to fight a big guy.
I love it. I'm glad that comic was there for you at that time.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I mean, I think just to revisit it now, yeah, you need to have like more character building and hold off on the twist. And then just as like, this is just like my little sidebar thing, but like I mentioned that I really like Mark Bagley at the beginning of this, and like as I was reading this, I was like, man, his art does not seem that great at points in this book. And I went back and I looked at like Ultimate Spider-Man, and I'm like, no, like this looks still good. And so like I do actually think the inker did not do his work service here. I think, and I don't know, like I think this is the Marvel method
Oh,
again, where
interesting. That's too bad.
pencil loose and then the inker kind of tightens it up. And like when Randy Emberlin is inking Mark Bagley stuff in Amazing Spider-Man, it looks great. And I think that I can't remember the primary is Vince Russell. I think Vince Russell does not complement Bagley's work as well as other inkers on other projects. And
How
that's maybe
funny. The
that's
inking was one of the things that I picked up on as liking in this
oh,
book.
okay.
I really liked the inking style in this book. It's very distinctive of this era of superhero comics, and I was liking the inking in this. So I understand what you're saying is that it might not be the best compliment for the
Yeah.
artist, but I think the anchor is doing his best in the Marvel way. Let's put it that way.
Apologies, Vince Russell. You did a you inked. It was great, but just like I think, I know that like different pencilers will, like especially like established artists like Jim Lee. Jim Lee will only let Scott Williams ink his work now, and there's a reason for that. It's like Scott Williams gets it. Scott Williams brings out the best in Jim Lee's work, and I just sort of feel like maybe other inkers have brought things out of Bagley's work that I think I'm not seeing here. And that's just speaking as someone who's stared at a lot of Mark Bagley work, there's something that felt a little off for me. But if you're not seeing it, that's good. That just means I'm acclimatized to a very particular style of inking.
Inking matters. You know, I think that it's an unsung kind of role within the comics framework, but it does make an impact, absolutely.
I mean, the other thing I considered is throughout the entire run of the Thunderbolts, Mark Bagley did not stop producing issues of Amazing Spider-Man. So he was like doing two monthly books.
Oh my goodness.
So like, I mean, again, maybe I don't know all the ins and outs, but I would also assume if you're a comic book artist and you have Amazing Spider-Man and Thunderbolts, I think you're bringing your A game to Amazing Spider-Man if you're having an off day.
that would make sense. Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know. I haven't been commenting on this art because it's not my favorite, but it's not bad. It's
enjoyed
fine.
The dynamic poses.
Yeah,
there was a lot of dynamism to the poses, and I liked that.
I think the number one thing that I still carry forward is like the posing
and the eyes.
Yeah,
you picked up a lot on how he draws eyes.
Yes.
Oh yeah, yeah, I see it. Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, I used to trace different artists' work to try and learn from it, and so I traced.
I mean, that's what you do, right?
Yeah.
Traced a lot of Bagley pages.
Wonderful. Yeah, I used to do a lot of direct reference with various comics that I liked.
I traced a lot of Jim Davis once upon a time. Final thoughts?
I learned a lot.
Hey.
Thank you for recommending it. I think something that I really appreciate about us as the Trade Waiters is that while I don't think our tastes are that distinct now, we have such different histories and such different perspectives on comics as a genre, and I really appreciate that about us as a group. Thank you for recommending this book, Jeffrey.
Oh, sure. It's my pleasure.
And I would say, like, oh, sorry. If you're interested in superhero comics, it's an interesting one to dig into. I like how it's self-contained is. So if you pick up this omnibus and you can get through it, it feels satisfying at the end of it. You won't feel like robbed of your time or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed the second half a lot better than the first half. It took a long time to get there for me, and I don't know that I would recommend this unless you are already a fan of 90s superhero comics, in which case it'll be much easier for you to read than otherwise. I can see the good that's in this. I can see why people like this. I can see why you like this. It was harder for me to access that good stuff, but the good stuff is definitely there.
Cheers. Well, yeah, like I say, it was interesting to kind of revisit this. This was definitely like a nostalgia pick, and I'm glad you guys ultimately, I think, had an interesting experience reading it, because I think I had moments where I was like, I don't know, maybe I'm asking a little too much with this one. There's definitely moments I sort of had to take a break. I think my suggestion, even though I understand being completist, I would say maybe we don't need the Hulk and the Heroes for Hire. I don't think it really forwarded the narrative. At least the Spider-Man team-up one contributed a plot point to the ending, but I don't know if they needed all of the stuff. But
I mean, we talked about this off camera. I feel like the Heroes for Hire one was the only one that felt like it was outside the flow of the story. The other ones, like, it just felt like this was part of the narrative.
Yeah, right. And they provided some fun cameos. And also, I'm glad that I didn't have to go hunting for them in a completely different trade.
Oh yeah.
Yes. Oh yeah. No. Well, I mean, I guess yeah, that's the advantages. It's all here. It's all in one space. And yeah, no, I don't know. I enjoyed it. It made me think about that whole kind of run, and I kept waiting for like they fight a villain called Gravitron, and then now I'm like, oh, that happens after the 12 issues, so never mind. But like, that was a fun. There's a fun thing I remember from that. Well, I'll finish with this. That's this kind of connects to the Zemo thing from before, because they fight this villain and he's super powerful and he's got them all pinned down. They're powerless and they cannot fight him. And then Meteorite is like, okay, so like, what now? And he's like, what do you mean? They're like, well, what's your plan? And he's like, oh, I don't know. Well, like, okay, you got all this power, but like, what are you going to do? And he's like, oh. And then he just like leaves. He's like, he
Is pretty
realized,
great.
he's like, oh, like, I think he was like, he was trapped in something and they accidentally freed him. And like, so he's super powerful, but then he realizes like he doesn't actually have a plan. So he just like goes away. And then he like several issues later, he comes back. He's like, oh, I figured it out. I have a plan now. I did like that. There was this moment where they defeated a villain by just being like, well, what exactly is your plan? And he's like, oh, I'm so embarrassed right now. Goodbye.
Specifically, Meteorite did that because that's her whole thing.
Talk about imposter syndrome, man.
All right.
So our next episode is going to be a two-parter on O Human Star by Blue Delaquanti.
Ooh.
With shout outs.
Shoutouts, yeah. Okay. So once again, I'm just reading books for kids. So I'm gonna shout out the one and only Ivan, which is, let me put it this way, it's very much the reading experience is very much like reading Charlotte's Web, so don't read it unless you are prepared to risk crying about dying animals. But it is also very good and very well written and has an actual connection to like some real life events, which I was not expecting when I started reading it. It's by Catherine Applegate, who is this one of the two authors from Animorphs.
Cool.
This is what she's doing now.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I'm Jeff Ellis, and I saw this at Indigo and I had to pick it up. So this is Stone Soup by Marcia Brown, which years ago when I was in elementary school, I saw Stone Soup performed as a stage play. And I'm fairly certain this is like a fable that's older than Marcia Brown's version, but it's like a children's book that won the Caldecott honor. And I just did my own interpretation of Stone Soup and as it relates to my feelings about Cloudscape. And it remains my favorite fable about why mutual aid is awesome. And I would just say, yeah, maybe check it out. Stone Soup by Marcia Brown.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm Jam, and apologies to everyone, but we're gonna have to talk about the comic that has taken over my life and is Trigun. Everyone, listen to me. So speaking of comics that you were obsessed with when you were 15 or whatever, some of them you go back and you're like, not this though. But other times you go back and you're like, actually, this is even better than I thought it was when I was 15. This is incredible. I love everything about this. So they recently did a reimagining anime, which I recommend if you've never done anything related to Trigun. The subtitled version is great. Even the dub is great. I love it. It's very fun. But it's very different from the comic. It basically takes the giant long comic and condenses it into something new. But it made me curious to go back and read the original comic. And Dark Horse has done something really, really clever. The original comics had been getting out of print. They had been getting harder and harder to find. So, in parallel to this anime getting made, Dark Horse picked up the US license and has been re-releasing them in these bonkers hardcover editions. It's got an embossed red leather cover It's got like gold foil lettering and a ribbon bookmark. It's a ridiculous treatment. It's oversized, but it is a really, really nice way to experience the work. And what's hilarious about it is that when you, because it's so large and so fancy in its treatment, when it's open on your lap and you're reading it, it feels like reading the Bible, which is which is thematically appropriate, and yet like the work itself is deeply unserious at many times, and so it feels very, very silly to be reading it in this big book, but I do really like it. And it's interesting because also the writer Naitao is still alive. He's still working and reading, making comics. So this is a great time to give him his flowers, I feel. And thanks for such an amazing work. He was very deeply inspired by Todd McFarlane's Spawn,
Oh,
which is
interesting.
something that is very, very evident in the way that he draws, which is very fun. And there's a book club happening right now on Tumblr. So if you search Trigun Book Club, there's like a group of people who are going through Trigun Maximum, Trigun the original and Trigun Maximum, which is the next series, chapter by chapter, and like working together to break it down. And it's been a really fun way to like go back and revisit this work. So if you're interested in some deep space planet future gun action, which is exactly what it is, check out Trigun. Come join me in the madness. It's great.
I respect any book that's gonna like go all out in the production. Like at this point, if I'm gonna buy a book, I may as well be leather embossed with gold foil and a ribbon. Like
It's
otherwise,
very ridiculous. I love it.
just be on my iPad if it's not gonna provide that. So.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know, Jam, if you've picked your next Trade Readers
I
book.
won't subject you to this. It's too ridiculous. It's too ridiculous and it's too long. Go watch the anime if you want to know what it's about. And if anyone wants to read the book, I highly, highly recommend it. If it is your jam, you will know very quickly, I think, whether you like it or not. It's got a dude in a giant red coat. He shoots things real well. It takes place in deep space. Weird stuff happens. Very, very weird stuff happens. It was the
You
most amazing thing
underestimate
I'd
my
ever seen.
appetite for weirdness.
I well then test it. This is not it's interesting because my other favorite series from this era is X 1999. This manages to be more weird, but more no, more weird, but also more cohesive than X 1999. X 1999 is slightly less weird, but less cohesive, and it's even harder to figure out what's going on at any given moment. And that's probably my favorite series. And this is.
Trade Waiters is presented by Cloudscape Comics. We'd like to thank Sleuth for the music. You can find us anywhere you can find podcasts online. Thanks for listening.